Hey friends, welcome back to this week's episode of Fit Friends Happy Hour. I'm your host, Katie, and this is episode 191, where I had the pleasure of interviewing fellow podcasters, Andy and Aaron Kraft of the Lab Rats podcast. Now, I actually attended their sleep recovery workshop locally here in Indianapolis. And after sitting through it, I said, oh my gosh, you guys have to be on the podcast because so much information, but tangible information, action steps, things that you can actually implement. And obviously you're here, you're listening. So you know that on Fit Friends Happy Hour, we are all about where self-care and science meet. And these guys do exactly that. On their podcast, they actually dive through the published papers, scientific studies, expert opinions, aka all the boring stuff that you don't want to read. And they simplify the truth behind the latest health trends. But then they take it a step further. They experiment directly on themselves to see if the results back the research. These guys were so fun to talk to. I can't wait for you to listen to this episode. And seriously, if you think you know about sleep and that you, oh, I've learned it all, I guarantee you there's going to be at least one, if not 100 new things that you're going to learn today that you didn't know about sleep. As always, if you enjoy this episode, we would love for you to leave us a review, hit that subscribe button, and let us know what you think. I know for a fact that Andy and Aaron would love if you gave them a shout out on Instagram as well. Tag us at KT Hake, that's my handle, and at Lab Rats Podcast, that's their handle as well. And share with a friend, let us know what you think. All right, on to the show. Welcome to Fit Friends Happy Hour, a podcast about all things nutrition, fitness, and life in your 20s and 30s, all from a non-diet lens. I'm your host, Katie Hake, and I'm a registered dietitian nutritionist and certified personal trainer. Join me here every week as I talk with interesting people and experts from all walks of life about their relationship with food, exercise, and their bodies. I am on a mission to help you redefine the word fit, to help you stop quantifying and start living. Learn to stop measuring your success by the scale and find your fears. Aaron and Andy are lab rats. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having us on. Happy to be here.
I am so excited about today's topic, probably for selfish reasons, because I am in a constant journey to optimize my sleep, to be better about it, prioritize it. So let's start by telling us just a little bit about yourself, your guys' story, you know, what brought you to even starting your podcast?
That's a good question. So Aaron and I are brothers, and we've kind of had different journeys to health or through health, I guess. So the premise of our podcast is we take popular, sometimes like controversial or fringe health topics around nutrition, fitness, just overall wellness, and try to experiment with them, see what the research actually has to say on those things, and then kind of report our findings. I think there's, in the health world, there's a lot of misinformation or confusing information out there. There's just a lot of information that's hard for people to sift through. So what we wanted to do is take some of these popular or confusing topics, condense them down into a way that's digestible that anybody can understand. So the format is we'll go research and actually like look to see what does the evidence actually say about some of these things. Because again, people will post articles, but there's not a lot of evidence to back some of these things up. So we want to figure out like what does the evidence say? And then how does that impact us? So we'll experiment with some of these topics and then kind of offer recommendations, not medical advice. We have to make that clear, but offer just like recommendations for getting started and experimenting with some of these things ourselves. And how I kind of got to this point involved my wife, whose name is actually also Katie. And she, about 3 years ago, she was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition, multiple sclerosis. And that was a scary time. She was having vision problems and her motor skills were kind of glitching out. And, you know, she was eventually diagnosed and, you know, we tried some different medications, tried some different diets, and we kind of eventually like settled on a protocol. It's called the Walls Protocol, specifically made for MS. It's kind of a diet and life, not a diet because diets don't work. Okay, a lifestyle.
He knows his audience.
Right, right. It's just a lifestyle that is geared towards people with MS. And that has just been like life-changing for her. Like she has so much energy, like her, she hasn't had like an MS flare up in been like over a year now. That's awesome. She said she feels better now than she's ever felt in her entire life. And that kind of allowed me to see just the power of things like nutrition, exercise, sleep. And from there, I kind of just started like reading books and studies and listening to podcasts. And it just became something that I've become obsessed with.
I love that because I always tell our listeners and tell my clients, like, ultimately, at the end of the day, we have to be our best advocate, right? And there's so much information and so much research out there about everything, but we have to experiment with ourselves in order to really understand and become the expert at our own bodies.
Yeah.
So Aaron, tell us a little bit about your story and how you got tied all into this.
Yeah. Mine's not quite as severe as Andy's story, but it's probably a little bit more common, like more often what other people experience. But basically, I was like growing up through high school and part of college, I was like fairly active. I was, you know, in multiple sports. I worked out. I ate, I mean, I wouldn't say healthy, but I didn't eat completely terrible growing up. So I was just an active person. And then going into college, that kind of activity slowed down those first 2 years. I was, you know, basically just sitting in class more, not in sports. I didn't do any college sports other than a few intramurals. So after about a year and a half, I looked at myself and I'm like, I just, for the first time, I could see my body shape changing. And that was like really scary for me. Cause at, I don't know how old I was, probably 19. For 19 years, I had looked almost the same and I started to see changes and I'm like, I don't like that. I need to start moving again. I need to get active again. And around the same time, my dad was involved in CrossFit, which is like functional fitness. It's not as intense as people make it out to be. It's a sport that anybody can do. It does look intense off the bat, but I started doing that, had a great experience with it. So I had been to a few classes with him and there was a CrossFit gym right down the road from where I lived at school. I went to Purdue University. There was a gym in Lafayette.
Boiler up.
Sorry, yep.
I have to add that.
There was in Lafayette, just right outside of West Lafayette, there was a CrossFit gym that I started going to. And I did that for about the last 2 years of college. And along with that, I just started to change my food habits. I lived in a co-op style house. I lived with like 60 other guys where food was prepared for us. And I didn't really have much choice over what I ate. So it was a lot of very, very terrible food. Just for example, our lunches were consisted of just pizza rolls sometimes. So not...
Here you go. Lunch is served.
Exactly. So those last 2 years of college, I really shaped up what I ate, shaped up what I was doing physically. And I noticed huge changes. Then, you know, fast forward to my first job. I was working in public accounting, which is a demanding job right out of college. And it's very time consuming. There are times of the year where I'd be working up to 80 hours a week. And with that, you kind of put nutrition, you put movement in the backseat. Like your health is not priority. And then I started seeing, again, I started going back into this, both this physical and mental time of my life where I just felt terrible. I looked terrible and it was not a healthy place. And that was about 2 years of that, working those hours and living an unhealthy life. And it was just a cycle that I had seen in college and I didn't want to go back to that. So I ultimately moved on from that job to a more consistent, you know, 40-hour a week job and was able to take back those healthy habits. And I just really just over the past 5-6 years, I've just noticed the huge, not only physical, but like primarily mental benefits of living that healthy life of eating well, moving, sleeping. It's incredibly just the shift it has in your mindset is massive. So I guess going through two cycles of healthy and unhealthy is kind of what got me to where I am today.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about just the different seasons of your life too. And, you know, I would encourage listeners to take a moment to just reflect of like, what has your season been in terms of just looking at the bigger picture? So let's dive into today's topic. And it, can you guys start by just telling us, right? We all know, okay, we should get sleep 7 to 8 hours, but why is it that sleep really is such a huge part of this bigger puzzle?
Yeah. So I think sleep is very interesting of all the different health aspects, because when you just think like to our core, what do humans need? There are really three things that we need. We need to sleep, we need to eat, and we need to drink. Like those are really the three things that we need to survive. But sleep is really unique from the other two, because we can go without eating for a couple of weeks and be okay. Like we're not going to go into this like a mental breakdown. We can survive without food for weeks. We need water to survive. It's about 3 days without water to where you will die from dehydration. But again, it doesn't cause this severe like mental hysteria. Whereas sleep, with just like 1 day of sleep deprivation, your mind shifts and it has a massive impact on your body. So there's actually a study done where they took a group of people and basically sleep deprived them for a period of time to see at what point they become both mentally and physically impaired as like a drunk person would be. And it only took 19 hours to where people were, both their motor skills and their mental skills were equivalent to a legally drunk person. And like, that's not very long. Like 19 hours, a lot of people stay up for 19 hours. Probably most people stay up for 19 hours on a weekend night.
Yeah. I mean, you think it too about like college students.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating.
It really is fascinating. And I think, like you said, most people know that we need like 7 to 9 hours. That's the general baseline. But there are, you know, people out there, specifically college students, who think they can get by with less than 7, less than 6 hours. But like in reality, there are very, very few people who can get less than 6 hours without negative, like long-term negative effects. There is a gene mutation that actually some people have. It's called the DEC2 gene. And unfortunately, there's no way of testing at this moment to test to know whether you have it or not. But a lot of people think they have it. In reality, you probably don't. But what this gene mutation does is that it does let you get less than 6 hours, like consistently, without any negative long-term effects. So it really is like a sleep superpower. But in reality, like, the percentage of people who have this is like 0.01%. It is very, very small.
I want to touch on that key that you said, the long-term effects, right? Because that's really what we're talking about is, sure, a night is going to happen. That's normal. But if you're chronically getting 4, 5, even 6 hours of sleep, what are some of those long-term impacts?
Yeah, Andy, maybe you can speak to some of the mental impacts, but I'll just touch on the physical ones real quick. I have a list here of like, so they basically, one study looked at all, like a bunch of studies done on the physical impact. So this is an accumulation of 750 scientific studies where they determined what the physical impacts are of, this is getting less than 8 hours of sleep. And the like very common things that they found over and over again in these studies were muscle strength and endurance, it drops below its potential. Lactic acid builds up much quicker than it typically would if you're not getting adequate sleep. Aerobic output decreases, our quickness and accuracy of our motor skills decrease, and our chance of injury, which is a big one, that dramatically increases. So basically, all of our motor skills are inhibited when we get less than 8 hours of sleep.
That's so interesting. And Andy, what are some of the mental?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many physical benefits that, you know, we could touch on too, as well as like insulin resistance and blood pressure. But one thing that I think was super interesting, probably the most fascinating for me, is how it impacts our food cravings. And, you know, for me, like when I'm up late or I haven't gotten a lot of sleep, like I love snacking late at night. It feels like I can never get filled up. I can just keep eating until I go to bed. And like, there's a reason for this. And so, I mean, sleep studies have shown that when we get less than 8 hours of sleep per night, and I think this study was done with people who got like 5 to 6 hours of sleep per night, it messes with our hormones. So number one, there's a decrease in the hormone leptin, and that's responsible for that feeling of being full. You know, that's the message that says to stop eating. So there's a decrease in that hormone, meaning that we don't get a signal telling us that we're full. There's also a increase in the ghrelin hormone, which is the hunger hormone. So it's telling us that we're hungry, and you're never really fully satisfied when you're sleep deprived. Mm-hmm. And so not only are your hormones kind of working against you there, on top of that, your prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for rational decision-making, is starting to shut down. So you're just more likely to make poor food choices. So your brain is not only telling you that, you know, you're not full, it's also telling you that you're still hungry, and you biologically have less willpower to make different food decisions. And a lot of this is just biology. I think a lot of people kind of guilt themselves over, you know, their healthy or unhealthy food choices, that you talk about that a lot, when, you know, sometimes it's a matter of biology or the way that this system is set up. Like, in my opinion, I think once you understand how the brain and body works, it can be easier to develop those habits. But when it comes to like sleep deprivation and food cravings, I mean, the idea that it's just willpower, lack of willpower, is I think a misunderstanding. And so I think, you know, for people that, and I'm not getting weight loss advice or anything like that, but I think people can overemphasize like diets and these different trends, when really just getting adequate sleep can be huge in feeling better.
You bring up that key point of biology, and it's so true. And I talk about this all the time, is that, you know, we can't fight our biology. Our biology is so much stronger, but our society tells us, well, you're overeating for all these certain reasons. And at the end of the day, you nailed it. It comes down to our body's trying to tell you something, right? And and by those hormonal changes, that is a physical sign of the body trying to protect you, trying to get your attention, like, hey, I need something. And so often we go, and we don't stop to realize, oh, I just need more sleep.
Right. Yeah. When you don't get enough sleep, kind of taking it more to the physical side, but when you're sleep deprived, like, your body and your brain views that as you go in flight or fight response, like the sympathetic nervous system is activated, and that, you know, increases your blood pressure, and it increases the cortisol hormone. So your blood vessels are constricting. And then another aspect of that is that when you don't get enough sleep, you don't produce as much human growth hormone, which is responsible for, you know, the healing and the repairing of tissue. So when you're sleep deprived, your body goes into this flight or fight mode, and, you know, it's telling you, hey, we need more sleep. And when you don't give it that, biological processes just starts breaking down.
Yeah. Fascinating. Any other things that we should know about? I think we've nailed it in, but why sleep is so important, but any other just fun nuggets that you guys know of that motivated you to be better about it?
Yeah, I've got one more for you here. This is very interesting. I just pulled up the stat because I knew it was high, but I wasn't sure how high it was. But there's a high correlation between lack of sleep and prediabetes. So this is in America. There are one in three people are prediabetic, which is in America. And that is an extremely high percentage of Americans who are prediabetic. And it says, this is on the CDC, 84% of the people who are prediabetic don't even know that they are. So they could be experiencing all these symptoms from prediabetes, and they have no idea that they are prediabetic. And what's interesting, there's been studies done on how sleep relates to prediabetes. And one study took a group of college students, people who were healthy. I believe they were even college athletes, and they sleep deprived them for a week, just for 7 days. And they basically allowed them to sleep no longer than 4 hours a night. So 4 hours of sleep for 7 nights. And by the end of that, just 7 days, literally every single one of those athletes were pre-diabetic simply because of not getting enough sleep. So certainly food has a big role in that, yes, but it's not food alone that contributes to that. It's food and sleep. So that was something that really kind of blew my mind, how much it impacts our insulin levels.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you're a college athlete, if you're superhuman, we all are just that. We're human. And so we need sleep. You guys mentioned that like five or six is under sleeping. Is that a word? So what really is the optimal hours?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Eight or 9 hours of sleep per night. Most of the studies look at like under seven or over seven or under eight and over eight, but really under seven, that's when you start seeing some detriments. That's when you really start seeing some issues. even if, like, even if you, you know, think that, you know, I feel fine. Like, I mean, I did that for years, for most of my life. I'd be like, you know, I'd get, I'm fine at six, six and a half, but there are things at work that maybe don't show an immediate problem, but that can develop over a long period of time. So yeah, I don't know, Aaron, if you have anything to add to that.
I was just going to say that that's 7 to 9 hours of actual sleep. That's not a time.
Oh, good point. Good point.
I think a lot of people like mix that up, because when you ask somebody like, oh, like how much sleep do you typically get? And they're like, oh, I get like 7 hours. And that's someone who like maybe they went to bed at midnight and set their alarm for seven. But just because you're in bed, like you have the lights out for 7 hours, you're probably only sleeping for 80 to 85% of that time. Andy and I both track our sleep with Oura rings. I don't know if this, you do the video version of this, but here's like an, it just looks like a wedding band. And it, we use it as our wedding band, and it tracks our sleep. So we know how much we're actually asleep throughout the night and how much we're sleeping within each stage, light sleep, deep sleep, REM. And for me personally, I, on average, sleep 82 to 83% of the night. So even if I'm in bed for 8 hours, I'm probably only getting like actually 6.5, 6:45 of actual sleep. So that's something that tracking my sleep has really kind of made me more cognizant of, is to focus on my time actually asleep.
Now, I mean, I think there comes a time when maybe you've been sleep deprived for so long. So when you actually do get 8 or 9, your body's kind of craving sleep. So maybe you still do have that sleep inertia. That's like that groggy feeling when you wake up. And that, I mean, it could be due to that, because people aren't used to getting that much sleep.
Yeah, that's a great point.
When you wake up also matters. Like the stage of sleep that you're in when you wake up will make a difference. So if you're in the middle of deep sleep or REM sleep and you wake up there, you're going to feel like extremely groggy. Where if you're already in this like surface level of light sleep and you wake up at that time, you're going to like wake up feeling a little bit more refreshed. So like if you've noticed, like some days you'll wake up and you're like, you're ready to go. Other days you cannot get out of bed. Part of that could be because you're waking up in a deeper stage of sleep. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's not much, I guess, control over like when you wake up. I know that Fitbit actually used to have a feature, I don't know if they still do, to where it would vibrate on your wrist and wake you up when it thinks you're in the lightest level of sleep. So you could set a range, like say you want to wake up at 6:30, you could say, you know, wake me up between 6 and 6:30, and it would determine somewhere in that half hour when you're in the lightest level of sleep and wake you up at that time. I don't know if it still does that. I don't use a Fitbit anymore, but
No, I graduated from the Fitbit. That's interesting though. That's really interesting. Well, I'm excited to dive. I mean, there's, gosh, if you're listening and you're not convinced now, like now you're probably like, okay, now tell me how to do the things, how to actually take action. So we are going to go through 4 different areas that we can all improve on. The first being limiting blue light. So tell us what is blue light? Why does it matter? Why is it harmful? And what are some things that we can do to limit it?
Yeah. So blue light it's in every source of light that you see. Basically every type of light has blue light in it. It's kind of hard to describe, but if you have taken like a science class, you've probably seen like the electromagnetic spectrum, which is like, it has like, you know, radio waves, microwaves, gamma rays. And on that spectrum, there's a little sliver, which is called visible light. And then there's like a rainbow of visible light. So you can like just Google this graph if you're a visual person. But on that spectrum, on the far left side, it is blue light. On the far right side, it is red light. And then all the colors in between. But the blue light, it's basically the highest energy of all light. So blue light is very high energy with very low wavelengths, whereas red light has very long wavelengths and it's less energy. So the higher the energy, the more it affects our eyesight, our brain. So the idea is that you don't want to be exposed to those high energy signals late into the evening. It disrupts our circadian rhythms at that point. Now, there's nothing wrong with blue light like during the day. Like the sun is obviously the greatest emitter of blue light, which is totally natural, totally fine. But like once the sun sets, that's kind of like the world's signal to us that it's time to wind down. It's time to go to bed. Like back in the day, just, I don't know when light was invented, but before light, like they did not have these like insane sources of light all throughout the evening. But for like now, as soon as the sun sets, like we turn all of our living room lights on, we turn the TV on, we have our phone on, our computer on. We're just like getting so much light, and it signals to our brain that the sun's still up, and it does not allow melatonin to produce, which melatonin is also known as like the sleep hormone. It's one reason that we get drowsy in the evening. But when you have all this light shining at you, it basically tricks the brain into thinking that it's still daytime. And again, there's been so many studies on this. One that stood out to me was that just like your average living room light bulb, that alone can reduce melatonin levels by up to 50%.
Wow.
Yeah. I've installed them, which I'll get into this later on, but it's like smart bulbs, so I can adjust the brightness, which helps a little bit.
But you guys should be proud. We just bought a house and we're moving soon. And that is one of our goals, is to make it a smart home.
Oh, that's awesome.
For some reason, my brother got us like all these smart light bulbs for Christmas. And we're like, what are we doing? So we've got the light bulbs. So I'm really excited for that.
Yes, that'll help a ton. Once you get those set up and start to dim in the evening, you'll find yourself being a lot more drowsy. But you also have to take into account to all the screens, because not like we could have the lights off, but most people have some screen on, whether that's a TV or a phone. And they found with like reading at night, so most people, I guess not most people, some people read at night. You can do that on a book. You can do that on an iPad. Most people these days are doing it on their phones. And reading on a phone before bed versus a book, again, can delay that melatonin release by up to 3 hours. So if you are laying in bed at like 9 o'clock and reading a book, like typically your melatonin levels would start kicking in right away. But if you're doing that on a bright screen, that could delay that melatonin and not kick in until midnight. So what you do in the evening and what the lights surround you, how bright they are, that really does have a massive impact on how quickly you'll fall asleep and how like well you will stay asleep.
Do you recommend like blue lights? You know, there's so many of those out there on the market. Do those actually work? What things can we do to help to block some of that light or minimize? You mentioned lights and not being on our phone. Is there anything else?
Yeah, we can go through some hacks. We have a lot of hacks here for this one. My personal favorite is the blue light blocking glasses. You may have seen these on social media, or if you've seen people wear them, they're like an orange or
deep. I got mine red. Here actually. For example, it's like this is my normal pair of like prescription glasses. These actually do have blue light blocking in them, but there's clear, so like it will block some blue light. It's more for like computer screens, but this is like hardcore blue light blocking glasses. Like basically, I wonder if you can see, like that's kind of like what it looks like.
They're super attractive for anybody who's wondering.
Yes. Yeah, you look really cool. but I mean, those are awesome because you can put them on and still have the TV on, still look at your phone, still have lights on. So like I try to put those on, you know, 2 to 3 hours before bed. And honestly, like by the time I'm ready to go to bed, I'm drowsy. Like it feels like I took a melatonin supplement. And you know, you can go about your day. You don't have to like turn everything off completely. You just throw those on. Back, you know, pre-pandemic, I would put those on. Like I would even go out to a restaurant. Like we were going out with friends, I would put those on. And so by the time I get back,
did your wife and your friends love that? Were they just like, oh yeah,
they loved it. They weren't embarrassed at all. But yeah, so the brand that we have is Ra Optics, RA Optics. And then there's a couple other brands like True Dark, Blue Blocks, Swanwick. There are some on Amazon, but there are a lot of knockoffs on Amazon that are just, they don't actually have the blue light blocking technology. They're just tinted orange. So those four brands I just mentioned are pretty good. But I love those. I mean, they pretty much last forever as long as you don't break them, and they just work wonders.
Yeah. Something else for your like screens on your phone, you can actually like change the tint of the phone to be like a dark red. So basically what you see through the glasses, it turns everything dark red. If you don't have glasses, you can change a setting. This is for iPhone specifically, but there's a setting deep into your settings where you can shortcut it. So if you triple tap your power button 3 times, it will turn your screen into this dark red, and you can still use it. It's not as like enjoyable to use like that, but you can still use it in the evening and it won't emit blue light. And this is different than, what's it called?
night mode, I think.
The night mode or whatever your phone automatically does.
Yeah, there is that night shift where it changes it. When the sun sets, it tints it to an orange. But this is not that. This is like a step even further to where it turns it like red. And you can just Google like iPhone red screen and you'll be able to find the steps to do that. We also have like a video on our Instagram to show how you set that up. But I have that set up on my phone. And like every night when if I use my phone, when I'm laying in bed, I always have that flip to that red. That way I'm not looking at this bright white and blue screen right before falling asleep.
It's also a good trigger too, of just to remind you, oh, okay, time to start winding down. Time to go to bed. Yeah. Talk to us about temperature. Why does temperature matter in terms of sleep?
Yeah, this is one that I think gets missed a lot. So, you know, historically before the invention of heat and, you know, regulated temperature, the cooling of the outdoors is kind of another aspect that triggered that it was time for us to go to bed. It was part of what regulated our sleeping patterns. And as the temperature, you know, in the air cooled down, as the sun set, our core body temperature would decrease. And that also triggered the production of melatonin, telling us that it's time for bed. But now we have our temperature constantly regulated, which is good. I'm very thankful for that. But our bodies now don't receive that cool down in the evening. So that melatonin production is prevented. And so one way to counteract that is to just intentionally reduce our body temperatures in the evening by 2 to 3 degrees. That tells our body that it's time for bed, helps us fall asleep faster and actually sleep deeper. So one way to do that is through a smart thermostat. Aaron, I actually don't have one yet, but Aaron, you've been big on the smart thermostat.
Yeah, I have like a Nest thermostat, so it knows my patterns. So I typically sleep, like the ideal sleeping temperature is between 62 and 68 degrees. Ideally year round, you keep your nighttime temperature below 68 degrees.
I know.
It is cold. It's obviously easier to achieve that in the winter. In the summer, you probably have to crank up your AC. But yeah, like right now in the winter, like during the day, we keep it like at 68. And then at nighttime, we drop it down to 65. But having like a smart thermostat, it learns your patterns and it can just do that for you. That way you don't have to like think about it. It will just start to get cold when it's time to go to bed, which is kind of another indicator of it's time to wind down, time to go to sleep. And that cold room temperature will allow your body temperature to drop those 2 to 3 degrees. It needs to drop to fall asleep.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But that one's, you know, the tough thing about that is like, you got to get everyone on board with that cool temperature. And I know that's not always the case. People run at different temperatures. So one way to counteract that is through another tool called the chili pad. And it's basically a cooling mattress pad that you sleep on, and it helps you regulate your body temperature. So you can actually connect it to your phone and you can set the temperature from 55 degrees all the way to 115 degrees. And so it actually cycles water, either cold or warm water, like through the pad that you sleep on. And so it keeps that temperature all throughout the night. And you can actually set a schedule, which is pretty cool, to wake you up with a heat alarm. So it just as the morning.
Fancy.
Yeah, I know. As the morning, you know, as the morning comes, it increases the temperature. So, which is, you know, how our bodies would naturally work if we were still sleeping outside. So that can help with not only falling asleep faster, but like sleeping deeper. You can get a single one or a double one. They are expensive. I think the single queen is like $500 or $600, which not everyone can afford. I mean, it's expensive. It's something you got to save up for. But that one is a pretty cool one that, you know, you don't have to subject your spouse or your significant other to.
But if you're somebody who, you know, really are struggling with sleep, and, you know, gosh, we could probably do a whole nother podcast talking about the impacts of sleep medications like Ambien or a lot of things that are out there on the market. If you're somebody who's looking to just like have better sleep, more quality sleep naturally, I think it's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an investment. You know, it's an investment in your health and in yourself.
Love it.
Psst. It's me, Katie. And in case you haven't already noticed, I kind of care about you getting results. Now, I'm not talking about results as far as body fat composition or the number on the scale, but I'm talking about implementing the things that you are learning here each and every week. Head on over to Facebook and just search Fit Friends Tribe to request to join our group. This is a free Facebook community where we talk about the podcast episodes each week, and I give you action steps on how to implement what it is that we talked about so that you're not just listening, learning, and absorbing information, but you're part of that top percent, that top 2% that actually takes action and changes their life. So facebook.com, search Fit Friends Tribe. I'm going to ask you a few questions to make sure you're not some weirdo from Antarctica, and we'll let you in. See you there. All right, back to the show.
What about timing activities? So you guys mentioned earlier, you know, food, water, caffeine. I mean, talk us through some of those different activities and what we should be concerned about with those.
Yeah, I think this is honestly, it might be the most important of the three. And it's probably like the boringest of the three because it's just like changing your schedule up. But it honestly has a big impact on how easy it is to fall asleep and how well you'll stay asleep. So like one thing with this is like on the weekends, most people switch up their sleep schedule. And then during the week, most people have a job and that kind of keeps them consistent with going to bed early and waking up early. But what this does is like having a schedule for 5 days and then doing 2 days on the weekend of like blowing off your schedule, it honestly creates like a jet lag for us. So like we think of jet lag as like traveling to a different time zone and then having to adapt to that. Well, essentially when we like switch up our sleep schedule every single week, that's essentially jet lag. It's just in a different form, but it's not good for our bodies. It's hard for our brain to adapt to that schedule because, you know, it's getting used to that Monday through Friday schedule. And then you go 2 days with staying up really late, sleeping in really late, and it throws off your body's circadian rhythms. And then you kind of have to reset again on Monday. And by the time it figures out its patterns, you are back to the weekend again. So like, honestly, one of the absolute best things you can do for falling asleep quickly is to set a bedtime and a wake time and really stick to that like year round, every single day, Monday through Friday or Monday through Sunday, stick to that schedule. No matter whether it's a weekend, whether it's a work day, just same time going to bed and waking up will have a massive impact.
And that's definitely a challenge. But I think for somebody listening, I would imagine that it would still be better even if you tightened up that range on the weekends, right? Even if it's just a few hours, you know, within, that's still better and it maybe has less impact. Is that right or wrong?
Yeah, no, I think that's good. Like even just, tweaking it a little bit, like rather than going from like, you know, maybe going to bed at, I don't know, during the weekdays, like 10 a.m. to 6 a.m. and instead of shifting that to like 1 a.m. to noon or whatever, you know, maybe just scaling that back a little bit. You know, I think the closer you can get to a regular schedule is better than not. A couple other things. I mean, there's a lot in terms of timing, but I think one that is very common is what I mentioned earlier, and that's like snacking late into the evening. I'm guilty of this. It's kind of that one time a day where you just can sit down and relax, and naturally you eat, you snack. Mm-hmm. And if you eat too close to bed, you know, your body is still trying to digest that food when you lay down, and that can lead to indigestion, which can, I mean, sometimes in some cases prevent you from falling asleep, but it can also prevent you from going into a deep sleep because your body's busy digesting food. So I personally try to cut off food at least full meals, like 2 to 3 hours before bed. That seems to be a good target. Same with water. You know, that can disrupt sleep, you know, primarily due to frequent urination. I think I mentioned this during our sleep workshop. I have the bladder of a squirrel. So I seriously have to cut off water like 3 or 4 hours before bed. And I know that's tough. A lot of people can't do that because they work out in the evening. But anytime you get up in the middle of the night, you're disrupting your sleep cycle. And like those sleep stages and those cycles are very important to get a full restful night's sleep. So when you're getting up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, you kind of mess that up. So one way to help with that so that you can cut off water, you know, a few hours before bed is just like staying hydrated all throughout the day. And then that'll prevent you from having to like guzzle down water in the evening. Mm-hmm. So that's a big one.
That's a great tip. What about caffeine and alcohol?
Yeah, that's good. Aaron, you want to mention caffeine?
Yeah, caffeine is an interesting one because it's not the same for everybody. We all metabolize caffeine differently. So like one person could drink caffeine at 2 p.m., drink a cup of coffee and have no issues sleeping whatsoever, where somebody else at drinking caffeine at 2 p.m. could keep them up all night. And this is actually interesting because you can get this tested. So there are two gene variants to determine how fast you metabolize caffeine. It's called the CYP1A2 gene. There are two variants to this gene. If you have one of them, you metabolize caffeine very fast. If you have the other variant, you metabolize caffeine very slow. And there's like these testing kits online that you can determine, you can see which variant you have to see if you metabolize it quicker, slow. But like caffeine on for the average person has a half-life of 4 to 6 hours, meaning that it takes 4 to 6 hours for the amount of caffeine in your system to be cut in half. So if I were to drink a cup at, let's say, noon, and the half-life for me is like 5 hours, by 5 p.m., I'll still have half of that in my system. By 10 p.m., I'll still have a quarter of that in my system. So wow. That's for just the average person. And this is even more extensive for different groups of people. So like newborns, we obviously know newborns should not be consuming caffeine. One reason for that is this, is that for them, the half-life in their system is 30 hours. So it stays in their system for an extremely long time. Pregnant women, same thing. It stays in their system for a very long time, 9 to 11 hours. That's what the half-life is. Something else that's very interesting is that, you know, females
take it. That's why I've never even really done much research into why the recommendation for caffeine for pregnant women is, I think it's really only like one or two cups per day, but maybe that's why.
Interesting. Yeah, that's definitely part of the reason for sure. I don't know if that's the entirety of it, but yes. Along with that is females taking birth control pills. It has actually the same effect. The birth control pill offsets the extraction of caffeine from the system. So for those people, the half-life is up to 10 hours as opposed to the average person of 5 hours. So it's different for each person. On average, it's 4 to 6 hours for a person, but it determines, you know, what group of people you're in. But if you're interested in determining whether you metabolize it fast or slow, you can test it on yourself to see what you do. And if you are a slow metabolizer of caffeine, then you probably want to cut it off at honestly like 10 a.m. or noon.
You're painting me, Aaron, but I get it. I understand it.
Yeah. So I used to only drink like one cup of coffee before work. So it was like at 6 or 7 a.m. I'm currently working from home now. And ever since working from home, I basically just like sip on coffee all morning. And lately it's been like into the afternoon too. So it's gotten bad.
It's a sneaky habit. I read something and was listening to something recently too, that was talking about how when we're consuming caffeine all day, basically what's happening in our neuroreceptors is that we're getting less sensitive to it. And really some experts will even say not having caffeine every day and cycling through it and, you know, maybe only having it twice a day, or it's really interesting.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's one of those things that I think it's so common that people do it regularly and it can be impacting your sleep. And the same goes, you mentioned alcohol. Alcohol is interesting because it feels like a sleep aid. Like if you drink in the evening, like, you know, you have a couple glasses of wine, you get drowsy. It feels like that's putting you to sleep, but really it's a major sleep inhibitor. So when you first consume alcohol, it sedates your prefrontal cortex, which is, as I mentioned earlier, responsible for rational decision making. And that's, you know, why you get a little loose when you drink too much alcohol. But then alcohol starts to sedate the rest of your brain. And that's when you start to feel drowsy. And even though you're drifting out of a wakefulness and you eventually fall asleep, you're not going into a deep, restful state of sleep. You're really going more into a state of sedation, similar to anesthesia. Well, you're not conscious, but you're not really going into restoration mode. And this can happen to some extent. You don't necessarily have to be passed out drunk for this. This could be with, depending on the person, a glass or two of wine. And, you know, we've seen in studies that alcohol, for that reason, significantly suppresses REM sleep. And we didn't get into it today, but it's REM sleep's important for processing emotions and memories, for creativity. And so when we consume alcohol too close to bed, we're kind of preventing our bodies from that mental recovery process. And I've experimented with this a lot. This was one of our first episodes. We did an experiment to see how wine impacted us. And for me, like even a glass of wine, that messes up my sleep. And Aaron and I are different in that way. Mm-hmm. Aaron, like we're brothers. I mean, we have the same DNA, and he can drink alcohol before bed and it doesn't touch him. So,
Did you test it by like with your rings? Yep. Did you look at like the quality of sleep or how did you, what did you
notice? We would drink, we actually started, we did like a, I don't know, a week or two with drinking a glass, just one glass of wine, 5 ounces before bed. We'd see how that impacted our sleep cycles. And then we did 2 glasses of wine. And you could see like for me, like my baseline compared to one glass of wine, my REM went down a little bit. And then when I did 2 glasses of wine, it like tanked where it didn't really affect Aaron.
Interesting.
Weird. But yeah, so I think with alcohol, like not saying like nobody, you know, drink alcohol, but I just, it affects everyone differently. So I think it's just important to be aware of how it affects your sleep if you're going to consume it before bed.
Yeah. And it's not always helpful. People always think like, oh, I need a glass of wine to unwind. It's like, well, no, there's many other ways that you can deal with that stress that won't have necessarily that domino effect of not getting enough sleep.
I was going to mention like going along with that, something like just a recommendation on something you can do like before bed to make you drowsy, like taking a warm bath or a hot bath, like at night, like that's a calming and a relaxing thing for people. But what that does, like when you get out of the bath, something that triggers is, again, something we mentioned earlier, is that drop in body temperature. So like when you're in a tub, you think it's like the heat making you drowsy, but really once you get out, and your body temperature just drops because you're going from a hot bath to cold air, that drop in temperature is causing a drop in body temperature, which triggers us to get sleepy. So that's why after a warm bath, people often get very drowsy. So that's kind of like just one simple alternative to a glass of wine. Maybe take a warm bath, sip on some tea. That's a very healthy alternative to getting drowsy in the evening.
My niece gets a bath every single day or every single night before bed.
Yeah, I'm sure she sleeps like a baby. Yeah,
she does. And what about exercise? What about people who exercise in the evening? What does that do?
Yeah, I think that's another thing important to not do too close to bed. So whenever we exercise, like obviously our heart rate increases, our blood pressure increases, our body temperature increases. And like that's totally fine and normal for that to happen. But it takes about 2 to 3 hours for those three things to drop back to their normal levels. So you don't want to go to bed when those, any of those three are elevated. It's going to make it hard for you to fall asleep. And if you've ever tried to go to sleep like an hour after a workout, I'm sure you found that it's very challenging to, like your brain's still running, your body's still running, and it's hard for you to sleep. So 2 to 3 hours is a good range to shoot for. Again, it's going to vary by person, but that allows your vitals to kind of go back to their normal state and allow you to fall asleep better. And I know it's kind of hard again with scheduling to maybe work out that early for some people, but just do your best to give yourself a 2 to 3 hour window between the end of your workout and when you're trying to fall asleep.
Yeah, I have a personal policy of no workouts after That's seven. Good. Like for me, it's always been more of a just like, I'll wait until tomorrow, but good. Mm-hmm. Now I have science to back me up of why I don't do it after seven.
Here you go.
So you guys mentioned tracking your sleep, the ring. Are there other apps or things that are actually beneficial? How accurate are they?
Yeah. So the Oura Ring is one that we mentioned, and this is probably the least invasive one. It's very small. It doesn't bother you while you sleep. You're not wearing like something on your wrist. So it's very easy to forget.
And it's a cool conversation topic. Anytime I show people my wedding ring and tell them it's a sleep track or a fitness track, they're like, no way. So it's a,
do you lift with that? Is it pretty durable?
That is the downside to it. It, you can technically, but it will scratch it up. And I personally don't work out with it.
Yeah. I do. I mean, the thing I don't like, I'll lift with it, but I don't do, one thing I don't really do with it is like pull ups. It just, that's hard for me, but it scratches up. Like mine's all scratched up. So that's the downside.
It's scratched up, but it's durable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like. It is durable. Yeah. 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 It also tracks other things. Like it does track your respiratory rate at night. It tracks your body temperature at night.
Your HRV.
What else? Like steps, obviously. HRV, heart rate variability, your resting heart rate. So it does track a whole lot of things. It's been my favorite thing. In the past, I've owned a Whoop Band, a Fitbit, and I use an Apple Watch too. All of those are great. And I say they're all fairly equally accurate, but I've ended up with the Oura just because it's the most comfortable. I don't like really wearing things on my wrist. at night. So the Aura has been very beneficial for me. But the Whoop, I'd say the Whoop is a really good one for people who are fitness enthusiasts, who are very active, because that one you can, you know, you can do pull-ups with, you can use it with a barbell, and it doesn't have a screen on it. So it's not very, it is very durable. You don't have to worry about cracking it or breaking it. Fitbit would probably fit into that category as well. So those are probably a little bit more versatile, but I personally use the Aura, and then I wear an Apple Watch to track my workouts, and then those workouts sync to the Aura app. So you can still have it all in one place.
Very cool. What about, do you guys have any other apps that you recommend or that you use, or should we not keep our phones? I mean, is it okay to use your phone if it's on kind of that different lighting?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to think of other apps. There are like sound apps that we use, like Sleep Pillow is one that I use. There's another one called, I think it's called Sleep Stream, maybe, that is like a white noise with like different frequencies. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to help you sleep. I haven't done a ton of research on that. Those are kind of two that I use. Aaron, anything else?
I think it's, does My Pillow track sleep?
No.
Sleep, is that a sleep tracker as well?
Is just sound, I think.
Okay. There's one I'm thinking of. I don't quite know the name of it, but I did used to use it for a little bit. It has like a purple pillow on it. That's like the logo, but it does track. It's a way to track your sleep without any device. But the reason it basically tracks it based on sound. So,
Interesting.
Yeah. It basically determines like when it picks up sound and assumes, I guess, you're moving in bed. And, I guess that's one free way to track your sleep. If you don't want to go out and buy something, you can get this app and it knows based upon the sound in your room. That doesn't work for me. I have two dogs that sleep in our room and they're always moving around. So I don't personally use that.
I did have a client. I can't remember what it was, but she used some app and she found out that she snored like crazy.
Oh, interesting.
So it was, I think that's just good information of there's different apps out there that, is it 100% accurate? Probably not, but it sounds like it's at least a good place to start.
Yeah. And I think if somebody's just like wanting to start tracking their sleep, I think the best place to start would be with a Fitbit. Like you can get a Fitbit there's all different versions of Fitbits, but you can get one like without a screen that still tracks your sleep, and it tracks the different levels of your sleep for like $50. So I think that's anyone who wants to start tracking their sleep, start tracking their activity. I think a Fitbit is an excellent place to start doing that at a decently low price.
That's a great point for somebody to, I know a lot of our listeners, you know, are trying to get away from tracking the numbers and calories and steps and something like an Apple Watch or, you know, might be just too much. So I love that you guys recommend like a Fitbit that doesn't have a screen that you can still use it as information, but you're looking at it maybe once a day versus all
not
day
where it becomes
kind of obsessive.
Yeah, that's one of the draws, I think, to the Whoop. Like, it seems like, you know, low tech to not have a screen, but I think, you know, we have so many screens around us. Like, we don't need instant, like, access to, like, oh, how many calories am I at? Like, what are my step levels? Like, we don't need that information 24/7. It can be very unhealthy to always be connected. So, yeah, something like a Fitbit without a screen or an Aura ring without a screen is nice. Like, I look at my Aura app just in the morning. Like, I check it in the morning to see how my sleep was and kind of forget about it after that. So I do like the no screen functionality.
Yeah.
I hope everyone took copious notes because so much golden information here. I actually went to, for our listeners, I attended Aaron Andy's sleep recovery workshop. Gosh, how long ago was that?
It feels like ages ago.
It was like
September, 6 months ago.
Oh my gosh, that's wild. But anyways, a lot of these things I'm still reminded of, I can improve on that. And I'm just fascinated by this topic. So thank you so much for sharing your expertise and just what you do. I think it's so empowering for people to learn that, listen, you can figure this out too.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think it's overwhelming, I think, but if you can just make small little steps, then, you know, you can feel better. And yeah, thank you for, you know, the stuff you do too. I think it's easy to have unhealthy relationship with food and some of these lifestyle things. So, I like kind of your approach to that.
We're changing the world one podcast episode at a time. So I want to finish this episode how I always do with my guest. What is the best thing? And it's Friday. So this is like a great question. What's the best thing that has happened to you guys this week?
I like that question. That's good.
Good question.
I mean, it wasn't this week. It was within the past 7 days, right?
We had
an opportunity to interview Rob Wolf, who is he's an author. We've like read all his books. He's kind of been, he's big in like the paleo community. He's also the co-founder of the electrolyte drink Element. He's the co-founder of that company. And I don't know how we got the opportunity to interview him, but it was like definitely like the biggest interview we've done. And it was just really cool it was strange because I've followed him for years and, you know, seen his face everywhere, and just seeing him pop up on our Zoom call was crazy. But it was a lot of fun. We're very thankful we were able to do that. That episode is coming out on Monday. So that was a pretty cool thing.
So exciting. I can appreciate just like podcasting. So cool.
It is.
Because you get like here we are right now, you just get to have the most authentic conversations, mm-hmm. and you learn so much while you do it, and it's fun. So I love that. That makes me happy for you guys. How about you, Aaron?
I'm just going to say what he said as well. It's been a pretty routine week otherwise. So it's been a pretty routine year all around. But I'll just say the same exact thing. That was a fun experience. And I love the podcasting community. I feel like with coronavirus, like it's a lot of people have started podcasts just because of that. And I think it's awesome. Like so many people are interacting with new people across the world that you would never have the opportunity to talk to. And it's becoming a lot more common to reach out to people across the nation and find these things in common in health that mm-hmm. we can, you know, help share each other's expertise. Yeah. So it's awesome.
Amen. Amen. And where is the best place for our listeners to find you? Obviously on your podcast, Lab Rats, and we'll be sure to link to that in the show notes. But where do you guys hang out? Instagram, your website?
Yeah. Yep. Those two, Instagram at Lab Rats Podcast and our website. We have all of our podcast episodes, video, some articles on there. That's labratspodcast.com. So check us out at those two places.
And you send out a weekly, is it weekly newsletter? I always save it because there's always awesome articles and very just simple takeaways. So anybody listening, be sure to subscribe because we need more of that in our inbox. Less coupons, more
there we go.
Yes, action exactly.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it. All
right, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Fit Friends Happy Hour. If you liked this episode, don't forget to share it with a friend. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook at Fit Friends Happy Hour. Talk to you next time.